I'm introducing you to a lot of people or not. If you're a Raptor fan, you certainly know this guy. But if you are a basketball fan, you will know our guest in studio. Bill Baino is the assistant coach for the Toronto Raptors, but has spent his entire life in and around this game. Good to see you. Thanks a lot for coming in.
No problem. Good to be here.
You started quite naturally. Your dad was a coach, right?
Yeah. Yep. High school coach, coached me.
Was that a good experience or a bad one? Because it can be both.
Yeah, no, I mean, there were good and bad, but there was a lot more good. You know, it was probably harder on him. I wasn't the most coachable kid. And, you know, you going through that, you learn how hard coaching is. And, you know, I drove him crazy a bunch. I've got a great story, a true story that I tell to all my friends back home, playing in the state tournament. And we were playing a really good team. No one from here would know them, but it goes down to the wire. And I had known a lot of the players from the other team. I played at a Catholic school. We were kind of a small school, but we played the right way, and we moved the ball, and we played an inner-city team. And so, long story short, we're up probably two or three with about 15 seconds to go. And my dad calls timeout to run an inbounds play to get me the ball. They're going to foul or trap us, but probably foul. I think we're probably up four at the time. And so the guy who was taking it out was a sophomore who looked up to me. I was a senior and star of the team. And so coming out of the timeout, I grabbed him and said, look, we're not running that play.
Oh, nice.
And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, we're going to run the play, but instead of you throwing me the ball, I'm going to fake, you know, come to you and just throw it deep. I'm going to go down and dunk it. And, you know, you're going to be a hero. I'm going to be a hero. And just trust me, it's going to work. And he's like, I'm not doing it. Your father's going to kill me. We had another assistant coach on the team who was like my second dad, who was 6'8", and named Dick O'Neill. He said, Mr. O'Neill's really going to kill me. I'm not doing it. I said, I'm going to kill you if you don't do it. So just do it. Trust me. So I take him deep. They bite on it. They try to deny. I'm wide open going down the court. He throws a perfect pass, soft, high.
Don't tell me you fumble it.
Right off the scoreboard, hanging from the middle. We played at a junior college. Hit the scoreboard. So now I'm at our basket, which was by our bench, and my dad is on the court, Dick O'Neill. They're trying to kill me. I pretend like I can't hear him. And thank God we went down. We got to stop. And they fouled us, and we won the game, but that's just a good example of how hard coaching is. And I was a coach's son, but, you know, when you're young and dealing with a lot of young kids, they're going to do dumb things. So
was there a point when you were playing that you thought about a career in coaching?
Yeah, that really came from the five-star camp in the United States. Five-star before the Adidas and the Nike camps were around.
Yeah, I remember.
Jordan went to five-star. Moses Malone went to five-star. It was the premier camp in the entire country. And I was a five-star camper. And then after my freshman year in college, I went back to work the camp as a counselor. And we would work 5, 6, 7 weeks a summer. That's where I got the coaching bug. Obviously, I got it from my dad, but I got the college coaching bug because Patino, and that's where I met John Calipari. We became close friends. And you would see them. They would come to the camp to evaluate and recruit, and they would all pull up in their Cadillacs, and they'd have their, you know, nice sweatsuits on. And, you know, we would see them, and they would watch, you know, the kids play and evaluate the kids. And it was like, I think I want to coach in college. I want to be a recruiter and learn how to coach. And so that's where I got the bug, and that's really where I got my start. That's where I learned how to coach. You know, and it's a who's who of NBA and college coaches that worked the camp, that were part of the camp. And we were able to coach great players. You know, coached a bunch of pros at that camp. I coached Alonzo Mourning, Muggsy Bogues. I saw Muggsy up in Montreal, and I was trying to get his attention because I wanted to see if he remembered me, because I used to steal lemons for Muggsy out of the kitchen cafeteria so he could go back to his dorm room and make lemonade, and he loved me.
Oh, no.
So, but, you know, that's where I got it, the five-star camp. Howard Garfinkel runs it. He's a famous New York basketball icon, still going strong. He's since sold five-star, and Nike and Adidas really put it out of the talent business. They don't get the talent that they used to. They still have the camp, but It was back in the day. That was the breeding ground. Patino, Calipari, Hubie Brown, Chuck Daly, Fratello. You can go on and on. Herb Sendek. Half the Big East coaches were groomed there. So a heavy East Coast flavor to it. But we also had a lot of L.A. kids that would come out and a lot of Midwest kids as well. Rick Fox, I coached there from the five-star camp.
Did you really?
Yeah. You know, so it's that's where I learned really how to coach, and that's where I got the coaching bug.
You get an opportunity pretty quickly to be an assistant with some high profile programs, Seton Hall, Kansas, and then a long run at UMass. Tell us about your time at UMass.
Well, I played there for 2 years. Yep. Was recruited by Ray Wilson, who was Dr. J's high school coach, yep, and who brought Dr. J there. Ray got fired my freshman year, and Tom McLaughlin came in. Tom was an assistant at Notre Dame. And Tom, you know, we're friends to this day, but that wasn't a fun year for me. He kind of felt like he needed to change the program, and rightfully so. We were bad. He brought in a freshman recruiting class, and I really didn't get a chance to play. He'd actually play me on the road, but he wouldn't play me at home. For whatever reason. And so I decided to transfer.
Yeah, you transferred out.
Transferred out. But, you know, I always knew the place had potential. And Cal and I had become really close friends at Five Star. He was at Pitt. And I was in my, I think, third year in coaching. I was at a little small school called Baptist College. It's now Charleston Southern in Charleston, South Carolina. And he called and he said, "Hey, I'm interviewing up at UMass. Tell me about it." And I said, "It's a sleeping giant, John." I said, some things have to change. You have to get some support from the administration and some money to really do it right. But it's an unbelievable campus. It's got great student fan base. You can recruit there. It's a great little college town. And, you know, he said, "Well, if I get the job, will you come with me?" I said, "Absolutely." And so we got up there, and they were one of the 10 worst teams in Division I. Our first year was crazy. I can remember we had our offices were just cubicles. You didn't have any privacy. And we shared them with the women's coaches. And so you're talking on the phone recruiting, and you can hear everyone talking. When I say cubicle, it was just about a 6-foot partition,
right,
that everybody had. We had rotary phones. You know,
wow.
So John did an unbelievable job in coming in and totally changing the culture. And he fought for everything. He upgraded everything first to first class. We were able to recruit, and we slowly but surely brought in some really good players. We ended up getting a new arena built that John was behind that. And our first recruiting class, we had some really good European players. Tony Barbee, who was the head coach at Auburn. He's now Cal's assistant. He was one of our first recruits, along with Harper Williams, who played in the NBA. Didn't make the NBA, played in Europe for 15, 20 years. And then we got Lou Rowe, who played in the NBA for a couple years and was a high school All-American. And then Marcus Camby tipped the scales for us. But we really literally went from one of the 10 worst programs to we were number one in the country,
yep,
for a good portion of a lot of years. And we had the place was rocking. It was unbelievable. We sold out every single game. Everywhere we went, we brought fans with us on the road. And it was a fun, special time. A lot of my best memories in life are from those years at UMass, the zoo.
Yeah. So then, speaking of the zoo, so then you go from one zoo to another zoo. Because in the mid-90s, you get a phone call, I guess, and you interview for the UNLV job.
Yeah, Mark Warkentine, who was a close friend, who was the main recruiter during the Tarkanian years. And I was close with Mark and close with Tim Gergerich. And, you know, they had gone through Rowley and didn't have a success. And they went through three of Tark's other assistants. Gerg was there for a little bit. And then Howie Landa and Clee Edwards. And so it was kind of, you know, they had hit the bottoms and the skids, and not a lot of coaches, a lot of good mid-major or other head coaches wanted to take the job. They turned it down. And Herbie Sendek was at Miami of Ohio, and he was really their first choice. And Warkentine called me up and said, "Hey, I'm going to get you an interview, and I think you can get this job. I think they're going to end up, you know, you know, I think you'd have a good shot. And so I said, I'm all for it. And we were at the time, we're playing Big Country Reeves, who was a Vancouver Grizzly,
yep.
After that, in the Final Eight in the Meadowlands. And we lost the game, and the president of the university, Kenny Gwynn, who was also a two- or three-term governor, great man, unfortunately passed away, was a dear friend of mine and a big supporter, and his wife, Dima, as well. But he called me and said, can you get on a plane after the game? And I said, yeah. So I flew out. I think that was on a Sunday afternoon. Interviewed all day Monday, 6, 7, 8 hours.
And wow.
He was honest with me and said, look, you know, we're going to talk to Herbie tomorrow, but I don't want you to leave. I want you to stay here in town. I'm going to get you a room at the Tropicana. So I stayed at the Tropicana for...
Could have got you a better hotel than the Trop.
Yeah, but they were trying to hide me. But back then, you know, that was before. There was no Bellagio. There was no...
No, I know.
There was none of those. And they were trying to keep it low-key. And I didn't care. I was just happy to be there. But the funny story was I had literally hundreds of phone calls every day just from people trying to find out what was going on, from friends, from family, reporters, media. So I literally would have to put a baseball hat on to leave and go out and go work out or go get a run. And after a while, the operator called me. She said, who are you? And I said, what do you mean? She goes, I'm getting like 100 phone calls an hour. I said, well, look, here's the deal. I said, I'm not taking any of them. There's only going to be a few that I really want to take. I don't want to talk to anyone. I didn't want anyone to even know I was hiding out. I figured the more people that know, the more people might take shots at you. And other coaches were trying to get the job. So I said, I'm gonna call down and I'm gonna hang up. Call me. And I said, if I hang up twice, I don't want the call. If I hang up once, call me back and I'll pick the phone up. So we had this little
system
going, and sure enough, Herbie ended up turning it down and I got the job, and the rest is history.
Were you cautious about taking that job? I mean, you had to be aware of what had gone on. Like, Tark had been gone 4 or 5 years, maybe not that long, well, 4 years, I guess.
Yeah, probably four.
You know, they'd won the national championship, the undefeated season, Duke beats them. The NCAA lowers the boom. And I mean, I was there for all of that. And I mean, you know, just as a basketball guy, what UNLV went through, what that whole program went through during that period of time. Were you cautious?
No, I was aware.
Because it's an opportunity.
And I was aware of all that.
Everything
you just talked about is why Herbie didn't want the job. Why coaches that already had a good job.
Right.
Weren't going to take that risk because it was a huge, huge risk. But for me, being a 32-year-old assistant, to get a job like that, there was not even any thought whatsoever. It was, let's go for it. Let's make the most of it. I was still, you know, wanted my opportunity to be a head coach. I knew I was going to learn on the job. I wasn't cautious. I knew the pitfalls. I knew the obstacles that awaited the NC2A, trying to follow Tark. Just everything, you know, whether the fans would ever accept you, you know, the expectations, how could you ever meet those, all of the above. But there was no doubt in my mind I was going to take it. And I think that was one of the things that attracted Kenny to me, is that I was ready to take it. I had no fear and no qualms and no doubts. And so he wanted someone that really wanted the job, that wasn't going to be afraid of any of that. So
with Bill Baino, the assistant coach for the Toronto Raptors, and we're talking about his years as the head coach of at UNLV from 1995 to 2000. So your first night at the Thomas and Mack, and you walk in, and I don't pretend to remember exactly what it was like, because I was there for both eras. I was there in the 80s when the place was a zoo, when Tark was there, you know, when Larry Johnson was there, the national championship team, the undefeated team, all the guys that we both know. And then there were times later on where there'd be 12,000-14,000 people in the building. It wasn't packed.
Less, 5.
Yeah.
In the end, the 2 years before I got there, 4,000-6,000.
So opening night at the Thomas and Mack, and anybody who hasn't been through, hasn't seen a college basketball game, at least when it's going at UNLV, you can't really describe it. the energy level in the building is out of sight.
The fireworks.
The fireworks. The band is going.
Yeah.
What was it like for you?
You know, it was really realizing a dream come true. I'll never forget. We played Cal State Northridge, and I think it was a 2-point game at the half, and we came out in the second half and ended up blowing them out, beating them by 20-something. But and even before that, we played an exhibition game. We played the Mexican national team, who had a 7-footer that played in the NBA, Horacio Llamas. And I ended up coaching Horacio after that in the old ABA league, believe it or not.
Interesting.
But even that game, you know, there was kind of new life, new hope. We had signed 4 or 5 really good players late in the spring, some junior college kids. So I don't know what we had there. I don't think we sold it out, but it was a
decent crowd.
Decent crowd, and it was the start of something that, you know, we ended up having a nice 4-year, 5-year run after that, where we were selling out every game and won the Mountain West Conference Championship tournament twice. We won the regular season twice and had unbelievable crowds and fans that stormed the court and some great memories and some good times. And but it was a dream come true, first night for sure.
You skipped over the first year because you won what? You went,
yeah, we
what,
won 10. 10,
and, 10
yeah.
and 20
We won
or
10,
something.
And that might have been our best coaching job, you know, as a
really,
staff. Huh? Yeah, because we didn't have much. And even we brought in a couple of those junior college kids. They were all undersized. And, you know, your first year coaching, you're obviously learning on the job. But we managed to eke out 10 wins and then brought in a big-time recruiting class the next year with Tyrone Nesby and Keon Clark. Two guys that both played in the NBA, and Mark Dickel, who was a phenomenal point guard, just a notch below the NBA from New Zealand, who played professionally for 15 years. And we ended up winning 22 games and going to the Final 8 of the NIT, and that's when the excitement really came back.
Now, I'll tell you a little story.
Okay.
I'm in the arena when Keon Clark is there. I was living back in Vegas, had my home there. And I watched Keon Clark play. And I called the Toronto Raptors and said, you might want to take a look at this guy. He is, and for those that don't remember, because Keon played a year, maybe, I don't know if he played a full year with the Raptors.
No, I think he played more than that. I think
maybe
he played at least a full year. I thought maybe a year
maybe
and
two.
A half or two.
Maybe two. You might be right, Bill. And I called Isaiah Thomas and said, you might want to take a look at this guy. And they sent, I'm trying to remember who the recruiter was for the
Jim Kelly, maybe.
Wasn't Jim. Was another, somebody, and I'm blanking on his name, came down, and I sat with him, and we watched a game you guys played when Keon played in that game. He was an extraordinary talent.
Yeah.
Skinniest legs I ever saw in my entire life. But a 7-footer who could actually play almost like a point guard.
Yeah, pogo stick, jumping ability, skills, passing. Didn't play basketball until his junior year in high school.
Yeah.
Imagine that.
Yeah. A tremendous athlete, but plenty of personal problems that eventually took its toll.
Yeah, and he's a great kid. You know, if he's out there listening now, I loved Keon. And Keon never hurt anyone but himself. You know, I had a good relationship with him, and he and I shared a lot of similar demons and similar issues. But Keon could have been one of the 50 best that ever played.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I read an article. He had some legal trouble with the law, but I read an article where he was incarcerated, and it was a very positive article in that he said, you know, it's the happiest I've ever been. I've been sober.
I saw the same article, yeah.
Yep, I'm sober, I'm clean, and so wherever he is, he's always in my thoughts and my prayers, and, you know, if he ever needed anything, he wanted to reach out to me, I would do anything to help Keon. He was a special kid, and I wish I could have done more to help him. You know, I tried my best. Ironically, you bring up Isaiah and Keon with the Raptors. Camby was drafted by the Raptors. It's
first draft choice.
Yeah, two kids that I had. And Sean Marion played for the Raptors for a little bit.
Yeah.
And I coached Sean at UNLV as well. So
Well, I guess, yeah, that would have been later in the last couple of years. No?
Yeah. My last,
like 98, 99?
Yeah, I only had Sean 1 year. He was a one-and-done kid. I think he was 97, 98 maybe.
Okay.
98, 99, I can't remember. And then I guess he came here just for a part of a season in a trade.
Yeah.
Or
Later in his career.
Yeah, it wasn't right before he went to Dallas.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah, he came from Phoenix, I think.
Another phenomenal athlete. Just a great kid. Yeah.
So fast forward. So now there you are. You got 5 years or so under your belt at UNLV. You've had a bunch of 20-win seasons. You've gone to the tournament. You went to the NIT once, NCAA twice?
NCAA twice, NIT twice.
NIT twice.
Yeah.
Things are going well. The program is clearly turned around. And then all of a sudden, poof, you're gone.
It was, the Lamar Odom situation. And Lamar is another kid that has a special place in my heart. Great, great guy. But at the time, there were some issues with his test score, and we ended up having to kick him out of school. The NC2A came in and investigated, and they found Lamar was taking money from a booster. At that time, I was cleared of any wrongdoing. I actually knew the booster. He was a friend of mine, and I had multiple conversations with him.
He's a local, right?
Yeah, God rest his soul. He passed away, David Chapman, who was just kind of overzealous and cared and was helping Lamar out. And I had multiple conversations with him that, look, you can't do this. You're going to end up getting me in trouble. You're going to get barred from the program. And, it was just something that he thought he could do and get away with, and really had good intentions. Lamar came from nothing, was out there on his own. But long story short, they ended up firing me, and I took total responsibility for it. I didn't blame Charlie Cavanero, who was our AD, or Carol Harder, who was the president. It happened under my watch. I should have done more to police it. But I don't have any regrets. I had a great, 5.5 years there. I learned a ton, was able to coach some phenomenal players, but also some great kids that are all back there, successful in careers. Warren Rosegreen, Tony Lane, Sunshine Smith, Damian Smith, it can go on and on, which is really why you're there. And the one thing about UNLV and the community, they take care of their players.
Oh, yeah,
and,
afterwards.
Those guys all have good lives. They're working good jobs. And making a good living and raising families. And Donovan Stewart's another one who's doing phenomenal. Names of guys that most people wouldn't know that didn't make the NBA. And then for Lamar, he went on to have a good career and made a lot of money. And, I'm pulling for him, whatever he's doing, wherever he is as well.
Billy, do you think that you would have been terminated had it not been for what preceded you? With what happened with the NCAA, with Tark, with that cloud that you knew was hanging over the school?
Yeah, I think there's a good chance none of that would have even come up. They flagged Lamar for a test score that if, how they even thought to flag him, there were rumors that, people from the old regime were involved and someone had to call the NC2A. And say, hey, you need to
something might be going on.
Yeah, you need to check out his test score. I think there's a good chance that never even would have happened if the spotlight wasn't on the school the way it was because of the previous regime. But to me, that's neither here nor there. I think I knew that going in. You and I talked about it earlier. We knew that cloud was over the school, and it was going to be a tough job. And it was a good learning experience for me. Like I said before, I have no regrets. We all have our journey. I had to go on my journey and live and learn. And I'm in a good place now and have been for a long, long time. And I owe a lot of that to my experience at UNLV.
I want to take a break. When we come back, we're going to spend some time talking about this basketball team as they get set for a season that I think contains more optimism, perhaps, than any in Raptors history. There will be arguments that when that Vince guy was here, there were a couple of years where people were pretty optimistic. But no more so, I don't think, than the fans of last year's team, which essentially is this year's team. We're going to talk about it. Bill Baino is with us. Primetime continues on the Sportsnet radio and television networks.
Now, more of Bob McCowan and Primetime Sports on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Six before the hour. Primetime continues. Bill Baino, assistant coach of the Toronto Raptors, joining us in studio. So if I told you that Timmy Gergovich was in here yesterday, you wouldn't be surprised, huh? Because you followed him a lot.
I'd be shocked. There's no way he was in here yesterday.
No. I just mean, well, you followed him at UNLV, then you replaced him in Portland, didn't you?
Yeah, I went in after he did. I wouldn't say I replaced him, but yeah, I was on the staff. Yeah, great guy. Ironically, and I was obviously close to him for a lot of years and still am. And his wife, Kathy, who lives in Vegas still.
Yeah.
But Tim has a place in Marina Del Rey, and I just bought a place this summer, and it turns out on the same street.
No.
We're literally three houses from him.
So this is an accident, Baino?
Yeah, no, it is. His daughter lives there.
Oh, yeah, sure.
His daughter lives there and with her family, her husband and her kids. But Kathy called me up and she said, I'm coming to visit you. I said, well, I'll be gone for 7 months, but I'll come back in May. I'll see you in May, hopefully June, if we get to the finals.
So if Tim moves, I'll get a moving truck for you, because obviously wherever he goes. So let's fast forward here. So, you know, you take a whole bunch of jobs, and we could spend a lot of time. Your experience in the Philippines, and then Portland, Minnesota. You wind up with the Toronto Raptors, but I want to bring you right to this year, because time is our enemy here. Were you shocked at how quickly this team came together after the Rudy Gay trade?
No,
you weren't.
I really wasn't, and you know, we all knew last year that the pieces just didn't fit. We had a pretty good starting five.
Yep.
But we had two players that were very similar in DeMar and Rudy. They're both really good players. They're both primary scorers. They both needed the ball.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Masai and Case at the time, and we all were trying to figure out, which move to make. And, you know, Masai decided to make the move he did and get rid of Rudy, which, when you factor in the money, was an even bigger, I think, coup, because he had so much. He had $19 million coming to him this year.
Yep.
And, you know, but it also solidified our bench. We were walking into the Staples Center, and Johnny Davis saw us 3 or 4 hours before the game and said, hey, great trade. And we're like, what are you talking about? Well, you guys traded Rudy. What? Well, who did we get? You know, well, you got rid of Rudy, Aaron, and Quincy, and you got Chuck Hayes, Grievous Vasquez, Pat Patterson, and John Salmons. So right then we knew, wow, not only did I think we really help DeMar and Kyle now, give them the reins, and we knew T. Ross was going to really develop and benefit from this with his increased playing time, but we had a bench. Because prior to that, we had a really young, inexperienced bench, and, you know, we were struggling. You know, our starters were winning most of their quarters, and so to do all that and to bring in unselfish, tough, proven veterans, you know, John Salmons had been in the league forever, and right away we clicked, and I don't think we were that surprised as a staff. I know I wasn't, and I think I speak for Coach Case and all the other guys as well, because we addressed issues that needed to be addressed, and we created some room for Kyle and DeMar to really blossom and flourish, and T. Ross as well, you know, not to mention JV. So it was just a perfect concoction. And I think from that day, from the day of the trade, we had probably the best record in the NBA. I think we were 43-22. And, you know, it was really a fun year. And you got to give Masai all the credit to pull that trade off. You know, we didn't think it was going to happen, and we were really, you know, the outlook wasn't too bright with the makeup of what we had and where the roster was, and so for him to change that all in a matter of one trade and really bring in those guys off the bench, and those guys were so crucial, you know, to really solidify and, you know, us as a total team.
With no disrespect to the guys who left at the end of last season, And the bar is set pretty high. This looks to me to be an even better team. Do you think?
Yeah, we have the potential, but, you know, that word is scary.
Yes.
And I think you have to guard against human nature of having a really good year, of coming back and thinking it's going to be easy and thinking that we're just going to step on the court. We have to remember the formula that got us there.
Yeah.
The unselfish play, coming out and playing harder than every other team, every single night, sharing the basketball, moving the ball, not caring who scores. Everybody accepting their role. And I think our toughest challenge this year is when you add pieces to a really good concoction and you have a great recipe and then you add a couple pieces that, certainly we need. We need Lou Williams to replace John Salmons, with his scoring. And he is an unbelievable, put a dagger in your heart, just natural scorer.
Mm-hmm.
And he's playing good defense. He's playing hard on D. He's busting through screens. He's really down in his stance and working. And then you add James Johnson to the mix, who gives us somebody that can guard the LeBrons. He did a great job on Carmelo. But also now you're adding one extra piece to a rotation that was pretty good last year. So guys got to sacrifice. They're going to get less minutes, and the roles do change a little bit, even though it's just adding one extra player to that mix. So I think collectively we all have to be willing to sacrifice. Some nights James may get a lot of minutes. Some nights he might not. Same thing with Lou. Same thing with Grievous. We're not really sure until we get going here how that exactly all is going to play out. I think a few less minutes for Kyle and DeMar is going to be a positive.
Long term.
Yeah, because we rode them so hard, and that's an injury waiting to happen. Playing 38, 39 minutes every single night. So I think that's a plus. But, we got some other guys that really had a nice rhythm last year. And so we have to figure that out. And that's something that I think we have to do as coaches and we have to do as players. And it's going to involve sacrifice and accepting roles and really putting the team first. And if we do all that, I think we can be even better.
Absent Rudy Gay, the core of this team, the nucleus of this team, is the same as it was at camp last year. And camp is camp, and we get that there's an asterisk beside that. But as a coach, was there a difference in camp this year? A confidence difference, an assuredness? Was it something tangible? Could you see it?
Yeah, 100%. 100%, guys were feeling good. We were all feeling good about where we are. But there's a catch-22 in that as well, in feeling too good.
Sure.
And feeling too confident. And, the preseason is the preseason. You almost sometimes as a coach wish maybe you would have lost one or two more to kind of be a wake-up call. I thought the first half against the Knicks was a wake-up call. We didn't play well. And mm-hmm. they kicked our butts. But the guys responded to coach's challenge at halftime, and we came out in the third quarter with our main guys, our starters, and we played Raptor basketball. And that's how we have to play, starting Wednesday night against Atlanta. And Atlanta is a really good team. Watching them on film, that ball moves. They share the ball. They have, individual scorers that are tough to stop in Teague and Millsap, and Al Horford's back. He's a load. And Korver presents problems, chasing him all over the court. So, there's no easy games in the NBA. And, it's a process. And this is a different team now. There's a different recipe to, we do have the core back, but we also have some new pieces that we have to fit in and figure out. And so it's not going to be easy by any stretch. And I think sometimes that's the danger, and fans don't get it. Fans probably assume we're going to go through the Atlantic Division and tear it up. And,
yep.
They forget that now Cleveland is a totally different team. They're an immediate championship contender with Love and Kyrie and LeBron, and Chicago's totally different. Rose is healthy.
Jalen back, yeah.
And Pau Gasol is there, who's a perennial all-star. And then they got everybody else back. So they're a different team. Charlotte added Lance Stephenson to a playoff team. So now they were an eighth seed and really good, beat us 3 out of 4 times, I think, at least 3 out of 4. They might have swept us. I can't remember. But they're better now with Lance Stephenson, who's an all-star, really. And then you have Washington, who beat Chicago in the playoffs. And they're an up-and-coming young team. And, and they've got some amazing weapons in Beal and Wall, and Gortat is a big that presents all kinds of problems. So it's going to be a battle, and it's got to just the one thing Coach Case has instilled in our culture is to get better every day, to be unselfish, and to play hard. We want to be the hardest playing team in our division. We want to be the most unselfish team, and we want to get better every single day. And that's really, if you focus on that, the other stuff will take care of itself. But there's going to be adversity. This isn't going to be a roll the ball out and win the Atlantic Division. You know, so the Knicks are better. You know, the Brooklyn Nets are better. They've got a playoff coach, an experienced coach, and they're going to be good. So a lot of good teams. The East is certainly a lot better.
I don't want to pick on anybody, but if there's one guy that we're not sure as fans, as outside observers, not sure yet what he is. And JV is a work in progress still, but we are getting a sense of his value and worth and ability to be consistent. But Terrence Ross is one of those guys that we saw that 50-point game. We saw a flash. And that can happen. You know, we've all watched enough basketball to understand that, you know, not everybody can score 50 points.
No, absolutely not.
But it can also be a flash, and it might be hard to repeat. His upside is almost unlimited. What has he got to learn? What do you have to teach him?
I think just to continue to get better in all areas. You know, the one thing that I always preached with him last year was you don't ever want to be labeled just a scorer. And so he really worked on his playmaking and his ability to make reads off the pick and roll and pass the ball. He's become a primary defender. We usually put him on the best player night in and night out. I think the tough thing, you know, all young players, especially their second year, there's still a huge learning curve.
Sure.
So, you know, putting in the work every day, putting in the film work. But I think also the tough thing, too, is you've got our two primary guys are both perimeter guys in Kyle and DeMar. So T's not going to get the most shots.
Nope.
And he's got to still figure out how to play off those guys, you know, with his cutting and getting out and running the floor and figuring out, okay, I got to get maybe two baskets in transition. I got to get a couple baskets off back cuts with JV in the post. I've got to figure out where to relocate in space when Kyle and DeMar are in their attack mode or they're in their ISOs. But those are the guys that are going to get the most shots, and that's the toughest thing for young guys to really accept that, okay, I got to, you know, and he did it great last year. He averaged 12 points, which, you know, I don't know of anyone else in his position. First of all, I don't think there was anyone else his age that started on the playoffs. He and JV were the two youngest starters in the entire NBA in the playoffs. So, you know, that room to grow is still there. The mental challenge and the focus, I call it the killer focus. You know, having that, I'm going to go out and try to kill my guy every single night and rip his face off and outplay him and outwork him and have that eye of the tiger, you're not my friend. I'm coming out to establish myself in this league.
Has he got it?
He's getting there. He's getting there. And it's something that, you know, some guys, no matter how much you preach it, don't have it. And he showed he had it last year. He's got to have it more, you know, and he's got to continue to develop it. But I'm a big believer in him. And, you know, I said this summer, and we all are as a staff, you know, you hate to put the pressure on and do interviews and say he can be this or he can be that, but I agree with you. I think the sky's the limit for him. And, you know, he's a young player that really, you know, he's got to get stronger. You know, we worked with him on his diet and his strength and the focus, those three things that are away from the skill of playing basketball, but are every bit as important, the mental part of the game. But he has a capacity to do it all and to get better in each of those areas and really become a really, really good, you know, player slash superstar in this league, potential all-star. Without, you know, putting too much pressure on the kid, but I think he can do it, and I think that's something that he's focusing on, and I'm lucky to be. I work with some great players, and you know, I feel really lucky to have the opportunity to work with him and help him grow and develop.
You talk to people who know you and have been around you, and they say you are an extraordinary teacher. Are you more a teacher than a coach?
Well, I think it's the same thing.
Do you?
Yeah. My mom and dad were both teachers, and my dad was a coach. I don't think there's a whole lot of difference. I think, You know, in coaching, the hard part is a lot of times you got to be a psychologist. You know, you got to be a big brother. You got to be a father. You got to be a mentor. You got to be a life coach, you know, to help these young kids out. But all of that is teaching. You know, every single thing I just mentioned is teaching. You know, you teach from example. You teach from the film. You teach with other players. You teach from the experience of other players that you work with. And then you do your on the court teaching, and I think that's the strength of our staff. I think we all have really good teachers. Nick Nurse, Tom Sterner, Jesse Mermis, Jamal McGlure behind the bench is going to be a terrific young coach, or who knows? I always tease him; he's going to be the next governor of Toronto. He could be take Masai's spot when Masai becomes the president. But Jama Malalea is a good young coach. David Gale, Johnny Goodwillie. We've got a lot of guys that know what they're doing, that work hard, but it is, coaching is teaching, 100%.
I got 60 seconds. This is your, I think, if math is right, about your 30th year in coaching. I don't know if you have thought about that, but.
I haven't. Well, I started
85.
Out. 86. So okay. Do the math.
Yeah, I don't even getting know. There.
God, I'm getting old. I'm getting old.
Welcome to the club. In 30 seconds, if you weren't doing this, what would you be doing?
Wow. Probably I'd be a high school teacher, high school coach, and, you know, business was my major, but I just think teaching and coaching was in my blood. So if I wasn't in the NBA, I'd probably be a high school teacher, high school coach.